Voices from the Food Frontlines Pandemic and Beyond is a podcast series from Feeding City, a virtual lab based at the University of Toronto Scarborough. Our team members and collaborators at the Feeding City Lab seek to highlight the voices of the people active on the food front lines, the people who have fed and nourished their communities throughout the COVID-19 pandemic, despite increased food insecurity, supply chain blockages, and widening social inequities across Canada and worldwide. Among them are local food producers, community gardeners, farmers, street and market vendors, and food sovereignty advocates, all of whom have developed innovative solutions against logistical and social challenges throughout the pandemic. Voices from the Food Front Lines brings listeners firsthand accounts from the people who have nourished their communities during global crisis and envisions pathways towards sustainable, local food futures in Canada and beyond. This project is generously funded through a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada Connections grant. For more information about the Feeding City Lab, visit www.utsc.utoronto.ca/projects/feedingcity. Today's episode is a recording from the live event entitled Community Cooks as Local Heroes. Feeding City explores Scarborough's food frontline with 5N2's Seema David, hosted by Feeding City. This interview is hosted by Professor Joe Sharma, who wears many hats, one of which is being a director of the Feeding City SF3 Research Lab. We will be hearing from Seema David, founder and director of 5N2 Kitchens, an organization dedicated to feeding under-resourced newcomers in Scarborough since 2013. Through conversation, we reflect on the heroic role of community cooks against the backdrop of what many consider a broken food system.
Through the COVID-19 pandemic, local food producers, farmers, farm workers, grocery store workers, farmers market staffers, small food businesses, family restaurants, community gardeners, and others on the food front lines fed communities in the face of health challenges, increased food insecurity, supply chain blockages, and widening socioeconomic inequities. The Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada has entrusted the Feeding City Lab and the Culinaria Research Center at UTSC with the task of bringing select community voices to the public. For this today, we are honored that food security advocate Seema David and 5N2 have agreed to meet with us for this. So Seema, thank you very much. What is the best part of your day working at 5N2?
I think at the end of the day, when I get a few minutes to sit with our team, which is a very small team, when we get to talk about the highlights of that day or whatever challenges we've had, that time together is really precious for me.
Who would you say 5N2 primarily serves?
So when we started 5N2, it's close to 10 years now. I remember that time the goal was to feed Scarborough, but I didn't know where to start, right? So any agency or any building managers, anyone who came to us and said, we have a need, for example, Bing Towers, it's a seniors residence building. And so we need food for our residents, and we would say yes. We would just ask a few questions, not too much of research into this, but we knew there was a need. Who's going to come and ask us for food unless there is a need, right? I always think even if 10% of people are taking advantage of us in some way, at the end of the day, you're feeding someone. The food's going to someone, and no one who has the means is going to come and take food off of us, right? So it's a lot of seniors we're serving, children's programs, people with disabilities, with mental health issues, new immigrants, refugees. We have calls every day from people from the community saying, my mother has come in, she's a refugee, she has no food. Yesterday we had a call from someone saying they lost two legs, so we need food delivered every day. It's hard, we cannot do that. In many cases, we cannot say yes, we cannot accommodate these kind of requests, but we try and pass them on or at least refer them to other agencies that may be able to do it. Because I'm sure there's so many, especially during the pandemic, we've understood there's so many new groups that have formed, have come into being to serve the community. So we try and refer them to other people if we cannot do it, because we cannot serve everyone in Scarborough, because the need has just ballooned up since 2020. We do serve a very wide variety of demographics here.
So Seema, you started almost 10 years ago, and you started in the basement of your own church. And of course, now you are working in other premises. But how would you reflect on saying that both your community of volunteers, your team, as well as the communities you serve might have changed even before the pandemic?
Well, 2020, prior to 2020, for the 7 years, for one, we didn't get any funding from the city. The city always said, when we reached out to them, they said, we don't fund food. Per se, that's it, we don't fund food. We give social assistance, and that should be sufficient for people to manage their food needs. But that's untrue. After people pay rent and utilities, there's barely like $20, $30 left for food. So it's a struggle between paying your rent, paying your utilities or for your phone, or having a phone or not having a phone, and buying food, especially for families with children. And since the pandemic came in, the demographics of the need changed, because a lot of people who were just there, lower middle class, they lost their jobs. Like, a lot of people lost their jobs. So now they've never ever been to a food bank in their lives, never ever dreamt they'd be at a food bank line. The people had no choice, right? And so the demographics changed tremendously from 2020. Prior to that, we served at a food bank at 4100 Lawrence for 7 years. And that food bank ran 3 days a week. And if the food bank was opening at 10, people would line up from 8 a.m. because they walked maybe 3 kilometers to get to the food bank. Who has bus token money? I mean, if you had $6 for bus token, then you'd buy some food instead, right? So they walked, or they lived in an underpass somewhere under a bridge, and they walked to the food bank, and they spent half a day in three lines to get those two bags of grocery. You know, because they come in, they stand outside before the food bank opens, then they get a bag where they pick a number. So they may have come and they're third in line, but they get number 70. So just imagine, you come in, you're standing there from 8 a.m., but you get number 70. So the next line, you're number 70. And then you register. So that's it's another 2-3 hours down the line, you register. And then you're in your third line to go into the pantry and get your food. So by then, 3/4 of the food is finished. So you're just going to get the leftovers, right? So in that time, we would serve them a hot meal. We'd go in as a team and we'd serve them a hot lunch. And so we got to talk to a lot of people at that food bank. Why are you here? What brought you here? So we kind of built relationships with a lot of our clients out there. But again, we didn't do that directly. It was a food bank run by another agency. And from 2020, we saw people who would never have come to a food bank, or who never, and there were no food banks anyway. At that time, everything shut down in 2020, right? So people started calling in for food. Even people, I had a call from Ottawa. I have an aunt who's isolated. She's in Scarborough. Can you serve her? So we had calls from everywhere, because we were listed on 211, to just people just desperate. Get my mother food, or get my someone food. And it was hard, because we lost 80% of our volunteers come the pandemic. I mean, who was going to take a risk? The fear factor was really high in 2020, if you remember. Like, nobody wanted to step out. Like, we lost most of our volunteers, and the few who would come in, we would pick and drop. Because by then we were essential, right? We needed, I remember my son, my older son is a paramedic, and he said to me in 2020, March, April, Mom, shut the kitchen down and stay home. You cannot go out there, because I'm seeing people dying every day. See, as a paramedic, I was afraid for him, because he was getting exposed every week. And he said, you shouldn't be going out. I said, but then if we shut down, who's going to get the food to people? I mean, people can't go to the grocery stores, right? I mean, people are so afraid. So it was it became a big challenge. It's 3 years in a row now. Of course, this year it's eased off a bit, but we're still getting calls every day for different situations. Now, people are still coming in. The country's allowing people in, but they don't have jobs, right? So it's just a very hard place.
What did it mean to you and your team to be heralded as essential workers and local heroes during the pandemic, but at the same time have to struggle to actually find space and the capacity to perform those roles?
I remember I got a call from Ottawa, from the federal government. Somebody called in to say, well, we've selected you as for one of these awards. And I said to her, I wrote to her apologizing the next day, saying, I'm sorry if I didn't sound very enthusiastic, because it really doesn't mean much to me. at this point. I said, because we have a lease notice. I don't know where we're going to go. We have to move out by the end of 2021. And I'm struggling to find space. Councillor Ainslie is looking. The realtors are looking. Nobody wants to give a charity space because they say, oh, you're a charity. You may not be able to pay our rent. Right? Because then I have to tell them, well, we don't have steady money. We don't have predictable money, right? We don't have, so they said, then why would we even rent you space? And most people don't want to give it to a kitchen again, because the, you know, the associated issues with kitchens. So I don't minimize the fact that, okay, yes, you do get an award, but really at that point for me, it was like, it didn't mean much. I'm sorry to say, but that was it. I said, I need space. And that was our biggest struggle for 2021.
It actually reminds me that right now we have the strikes by essential workers who work with small children and who, again, they've been told their work is valued, but then that doesn't pay their rent or buy food for their children. And of course, if we look further afield, a similar situation with health workers, both in our own country and in Britain, where the NHS people clapped for them, as you know, we did as well, for essential workers. But what does it mean if essential workers, local heroes, if these are empty praises that go toward them? So Seema, what does this entire undertaking of having to relocate the center of operations indicate about the stability and sustainability of food organizations like yours? And here I'll also remind people that food banks came up in the 1960s and were meant to be a temporary band-aid. But I think we can look around and think food banks are with us.
So we started off not meaning to be a food bank at all. It was just, I just wanted that we should be able to prepare fresh meals and serve it where it was needed in our neighborhoods. But during the pandemic, we added a program to be also able to send groceries out because people were not able to come out. They were isolated. So we have not become a food bank. We still function as, but we've changed also from being a soup kitchen because we're now providing other services, because the pandemic just created the need for certain services, our meal programs, which is all to go. A lot of the programs became to go because people couldn't come in. Finding space has really been a major issue for us. And I think this goes to show how, I don't know whether the city officials realize small charities like us, not-for-profits, need some kind of policy, some kind of support, steady support to be able to do what we're doing, because we're not a business, right? We're not selling product to make money. We're trying to rescue food and repurpose it and again distribute it to people who are in need. So our struggle for space has been a really a key battle all of last year. But the good news is we have space now. We signed a lease with the city on city-owned property, and as of today or two, we have movers coming in. So we've constructed a new kitchen, and we're just seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. So we're hoping to move in this month.
That is good news. And Seema talks of rescuing food, and the rescuing food obviously is a very, very important task for our society, for the world, because as I tell my students, it's not a problem so much of food production as of distribution. And so whether it be through the rescuing food to make it tasty, culturally relevant meals that Seema and her organization do, or through the community garden and the other food sovereignty initiatives that they undertook till they had to move, and which we very much hope they'll be able to pick up. But Seema, I also wanted to ask, were there any mutual aid connections or partnerships that have offered sources of support to overcome challenges that you faced?
So we've always worked with partnerships in the community, because I've realized the importance of working with partnerships. In isolation, you can only do just that little bit. But we have about 12 to 13 partnerships with much larger agencies that are very heavily funded. And so we give meals to them and they distribute it. Because, for example, I cannot go into, say, 4100 Lawrence, where East Scarborough storefront is. They have a connection with their immediate community, right? So we give them the food and they distribute it. Then we give food to Warden Woods, to Bing Towers. They manage Bing Towers and McLean Apartments. We give them meals, they distribute it. So it's crucial. Partnerships are crucial to our work. It's without which we really cannot reach so many communities that have need. Even children's programs, we can't run after school programs, but somebody else is running them. We provide the food for that. Right? We'll provide them little meals, I mean, little boxes for kids' meals, or even for seniors, if it has to be, you know, appropriate for seniors to consume, we provide that kind of food. But for us, essentially, we want to be a kitchen that can provide that fresh food to people in our communities.
So Seema, for this university community that's here, you were invited in the Great Exploration series by the Office of the Dean as Vice Principal at UTSC. What would you say to this university that exists in these larger communities? What would make it a true partnership?
There are a couple of things I always want to put out when I get an opportunity. One is, I just want to mention that we work, 80% of what we serve out is rescued food, right? 80%. Because statistically, if you read any reports from Daily Bread, all these big organizations, Second Harvest, we work with all of them. We partner as a small agency. 40% of what Canada produces, just think about the farmers, the dairy, you know, any kind of farmers, right? Any kind of production Canada, what Canada produces, the amount of labor that goes into that. 40% of that food is wasted every year. I mean, it's mind-boggling to me that 40% is wasted, and more than half of that can be rescued, really. Can be rescued and redirected. But it has to start from somewhere on top. I think, if I'm not mistaken, France passed legislation saying grocery stores can't throw their food anymore. They can be penalized. Why can't we start that conversation now? I mean, for us, as a small charity, I've gone myself to so many grocery stores in Scarborough to meet the managers, the meat managers, because the highest cost is protein. It starts with protein, dairy, and then produce, right? But yet, even having said that, it's easier to buy a pound of chicken than to buy fresh produce these days, right? 49 cents, you may get a pound of chicken sometime in the year, but not arugula or fresh lettuce. This is so expensive. I have a friend who has a job. She said to me last week, she went to buy groceries. She said, I left that cucumber, one cucumber. It was so expensive. She has a job. Her husband works for the city, you know, but she said, I left it. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, there are two jobs in that home, you know, but she didn't want to buy it. What about the people with no jobs who have six kids or, you know, I mean, the kind of situations we see, what about people like that, you know, and grocery stores are throwing food every day. But when you go and approach them, it's the bottom line is the dollar, right? It's their profitability. Now, to save the food, they have to plug up space. They need man hours to sort it out. It's easier to take that skid and just throw it out into the bin. Gone. No cost to you. But if you have to save it, put it up in a cold storage or the freezer, then call us or, you know, have a day, then we go and pick it up. It's all money for them, right? But it has to start from the owners. We have one, Michael's No Frills in Stouffville. They give us their protein every 2 weeks. So we drive up the 45 minutes to get it from him, from their store. But that's like 15 to 30 boxes of banana boxes of protein, which is like gold, you know. So we bring it back to us. We sort it out and we distribute it either to St. John's Mission or Salvation Army, one of our partnerships, because we are in a temporary space. And the rest then we keep and we send it to the one hotel downtown who cooks for us and sends the food back to us, because we don't have a kitchen currently, a functioning kitchen. And so the food rescue is the big piece. So there has to be a conversation somewhere. Somebody knows an owner somewhere. Somebody knows a franchise, maybe a franchisee with Tim Hortons. I'm not saying we want to distribute such sugary stuff, but then, you know, somebody who's really hungry may want that too, you know. But even any grocery stores or these chains, we have to start that conversation. What are you doing with your food? End of the day. Starbucks has taken an initiative last few years, and we rescue food from six Starbucks downtown and one at Kennedy Commons. So every week we get their sandwiches and their sweets, their desserts, and we send it out to communities, because they're all individually wrapped anyway. They're beautiful sandwiches. I mean, I wouldn't go and just buy just like that from Starbucks, but people are able to get that food, right? So we have to have that conversation, start that somewhere, you know. What are you doing with your food, you know, end of the day?
Thank you, Seema. I think that's a beautiful answer, because I think looking around, each of us can perhaps challenge our employers, whether it be the university for some of us here or our other employers or other, you know, maybe the neighborhood stores where we shop, to say, what are you doing with the food that you throw away? Do you have a partnership with an agency where, just as this one No Frills you mentioned, Seema? And I think, you know, when I think about how the different offices at this university hold events every single day, how we have a number of businesses on campus, you would have encountered, you know, the businesses as you walked in. So those are one way, for instance, an institution like this could perhaps help support your work. And of course, we have our students who are motivated to work with these organizations. It's good for them. It's good for the organizations. But this is where, you know, yes, I would say that the university needs to have a conversation to say, how can students, how can professors, how can staff members be actually able to use some of their time to support this kind of work? Because it is not just about cooking the meals. It is also thinking about those goals that universities are supposed to teach, how universities are supposed to prepare young people for the rest of the world, right? So Seema, would you, in your dream world, how would you see, say, UTSC work with you? Just, you know, very pragmatically, in a dream world.
Yep. We love having students over at our kitchen and, you know, have a regular kind of an intake where we have students come and get an experience, because when you get that experience, not in the classroom, but actually in a kitchen, that's a different thing altogether. And going and serving the community, we'd love to have that kind of a partnership with, for students, and also with the canteens you have on campus and the businesses, again, like you mentioned, and be more collaborative. We have to collaborate with the colleges and universities and schools around us. It has to be a learning space, right? We want to be that kind of a place where we give the opportunity for the community to know and learn young, you know?
We have a wonderful message coming from the top of the university about inclusive partnerships. And I think what Seema is describing on her wish list is perhaps one very pragmatic, solid manifestation. So I do want, you know, the people who make decisions at this university, but also for each one of us, the other networks we're connected with, to think about how perhaps we can contribute to our planetary futures, prevent food waste, assist in food rescue, but do it also by making sure that 5 and 2's 3,500 meals a week are enabled and without the struggles that they've had to face. So what is next for 5 and 2? What are your hopes and aspirations for the future regarding equitable food access in particular? Specifically, what are some important principles about sustainable and equitable food futures from your organization that you would like our audience here today, but also the audience that is listening, the audience that will be listening to this podcast recording, to take away?
So looking ahead, of course, we're hoping to move into our new facility by the end of this month and settle in. A conversation we've had over the last year with some of our supporters was, how do we look to sustaining the work we've started? Because we've really struggled 7 years, and it took the pandemic for us to get some attention from the government to say we needed money. We never got a penny before that, right? So it's only 2020, 21, and now 22. And we have to write grants all the time, and we don't have time. When you have 3.5 or 4 staff, where do you have the time to serve food, rescue food, manage volunteers, all the logistics, drivers, and then also write grants? I mean, it's very hard to find time to do that. But so it got me thinking last year when we had you saw the picture, we had a community garden, which we had asked 2 property owners to allow us to use and develop. And we harvested over maybe 800 pounds of beautiful fruit and vegetable from that garden. And it got me thinking that, you know, given we're in Canada and we have only so many months of the growing season, how can this happen around the year? And I came across hydroponics, and I said, oh, wow, this is something interesting. So I wrote into one of the companies that makes, they upscale these containers and have panels to grow produce hydroponically. So I approached one of our supporters and said, can we add a social enterprise element to 5 and 2 so that we can grow produce 365 days, market it, the same time feed the community with it, to teach them to eat more nutritious meals, because we learned when we were offering this harvest from the garden to our clients, my staff said, Seema, they're not taking these greens. I said, why wouldn't they take fresh greens that have been harvested this morning? So they said they just never eaten it before, so they're not going to take it. So I said, my goodness, that was a shock to me that they wouldn't take this fresh produce. So which made me understand we have to start from the bottom up, right? We need to educate people and give them that product, right? So I said, okay, so we've added this social enterprise element now to 5 and 2, where we want to grow produce. So we will market half of it or more than half of it to be able to sustain our work, because how long are we going to keep asking for money, right? Of course, we're going to need funding, we need grants, but I want to be able to sustain our work too. So we're hoping in the next 6 years, we'll be self-sustainable. So we've added this element now to grow produce hydroponically. And on the other side, we want to engage the community, teach them how you can grow produce, hyper-local produce, which will just be right there in your city. It just takes 40 by 8 feet, literally. So 320 square feet for one of the containers, right? But you can grow, like, if I'm not mistaken, over an acre every 3 weeks of produce in there, fresh harvested, and you can feed your community with that. So that's something we're looking to do by the end of the year. And so we also want to then bring in students. We want to bring in people from the community to teach them what we're doing. So to have that education piece added on to 5 and 2. So it's not that forever we want to feed them. Like you had said, it's a band-aid, right? You feed people, they're hungry. But yet, the larger question is, why are people hungry, right? But it's not on my end, I feel, not our end to answer that question. Why are people hungry? So when you're hungry, we are like the first aid response. We'll give you the food. You're hungry, we'll fill your stomach up. But the city and the government and people who are making policy need to ask, why are they hungry? Right? But we're not there to ask you that. If you come and say, my child is hungry, I'm going to give you the food. Right? We will feed you. But somebody else has to do the other part. So our goal is to become self-sustainable and also add this education piece into our work. So we're not going to be just only feeding people. We want to do more than that in the coming years.
Thank you so much, Seema.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Voices from the Food Frontlines Pandemic and Beyond podcast series. Listeners can learn more about the Feeding City project and stay tuned to upcoming stories from Voices from the Food Frontlines at our website, www.utsc.utoronto.ca/projects/feedingcity.